Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Lauren Groff's latest novel, Matrix, her first since the groundbreaking Fates and Furies, brings us to a 12th century nunnery where she tells an engrossing tale of female desire, passion, creativity, and yes, power. The novel follows the 12th century poet, Marie de France, banished as a young girl from the court of Eleanor of Aquitaine, to oversee an impoverished abbey in England. At first taken aback by the severity of her new life, Marie finds focus and love in collective life and with her singular and mercurial sisters. Lauren Groff is a two-time National Book Award finalist and the New York Times bestselling author of three novels, The Monsters of Templeton, Arcadia, and Fates and Furies, as well as the short story collections Delicate, Edible Birds, and Florida. Again, the new novel is Matrix, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Lauren Groff to this week's book show. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm well. It's a delight to have you on the program. You know, I was joking just before I came into the studio with our producer that I remember when Monsters of Templeton came out and the publicist was begging me to have you on. And I read your book and was wowed and was grateful to have you on. And now I have to beg the publicist to have you on. I like that story.
Well, I am begging to be on your show. So thank you.
Well, it's very nice to have you back on the program. Can you sort of figure out what it was like to then have such great success? And of course, President Obama coming out and giving you a tap on the shoulder and saying how great your work is didn't hurt. It seems as though that could and perhaps did get into your head a little bit.
Well, it didn't really get into my head, I think. I think I had a hard time writing well for about 2 years afterwards. That's normal. I mean, I think that creativity comes in ebbs and flows. I woke up every day. I went up to my office every day and I worked every day. But that doesn't mean that I worked well or interestingly or created any good prose that I could have kept. Even though I had a hard time writing stuff that I was proud of, I was still writing. I think eventually you have to figure out how to deal with attention or the lack thereof in writing and sort of disassociate or just separate the writer from the author, who are profoundly different people with profoundly different purposes.
So at what point did you, and from my understanding, it was a lecture at Harvard that ultimately brought this idea to you that even though you had known about Marie de France for many years and had studied the life, that there was an idea that this could be a novel?
I was working on a different book, actually, when I had the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study Fellowship. I went to my friend's talk thinking, you know, she's just a good friend. She's really smart. Maybe I'll be interested. And I sat in the audience and was blown away. This is Dr. Katie Bugis at Notre Dame, who's one of the most passionate, interesting, beautiful humans I know. And she just loves these medieval nuns that she studies. And she studies their manuscripts and she studies the liturgy. And she's so interesting and so knowledgeable that I found myself being sucked into her words and sort of riding on her profound knowledge and getting really, really actually like thrilled by what she was saying. And sometime, maybe halfway through the talk, there waltzed into my head this vision sort of Marie de France, whom I had loved in the past, who I had studied, and who suddenly showed herself to be this abbess that you see in Matrix.
And was it because you saw a way that you could use this subject and use her to deal with a lot of the other things that you wanted to deal with in a novel?
I think it was more an avoidance issue, to be perfectly honest. I didn't feel up to talking about all of the like unending, overwhelming waves of things that were happening in the contemporary world. I just felt as though I were drowning and the waves just kept coming and coming and sort of pushing me down. And I just didn't have the necessary distance to to deal with modernity with the moral rigor that I wanted, right? I didn't have the ability to understand everything, even as things were going on. So I thought possibly, my philosophy of historical fiction is that it is only interesting if it actually engages with the time at which it's being written.
Right.
And it needs to sort of, the past and the present need to sort of reverberate together. So I thought, well, maybe I could just deal with the contemporary world a bit through talking about the issues that would have been similar 1,000 years ago.
So enter the subjects of that you get to write about power and God and climate change and a world where women are on their own, are together in this communal way, which kind of checks off all those boxes, doesn't it?
I think, the other book that I was writing at the time dealt with all those things also, but from a profoundly different place. It was, you know, Elizabethan English, not old French. And it was Protestantism and not Catholicism. But a lot of the same things were definitely being circled. A lot of the same, it's the world of ideas was a similar world.
How much did you know going in about Marie de France? We don't overall know a lot, right? I mean, there's still a lot that isn't known.
Oh, yeah. No, historians still argue about who she might have been. I mean, it's one of the great, beautiful mysteries of the past is we're not quite sure who she was. And I think this is not abnormal for anyone who wasn't a queen back in the day. Women were generally seen as interesting relationally, right? Who their fathers were, who their husbands were, who their children were, not necessarily in and of themselves. So I didn't know anything about her because there was very little to know, like legitimately little to know. There were suppositions. She could have been an abbess. She could have been an illegitimate noble. She could have been, who knows, the daughter of Eleanor of Aquitaine from her first marriage to the French king. You know, one of the great joys of doing this book was sort of looking at all of the alternate theories of who she was and getting to select my own version.
She is in this world that is shifting and moving, and she never quite is able to reconcile herself with that. And a lot of that seems to be in the way that she has grown up as being called big and ugly and sort of being cast aside. And yet she commands power.
Yeah. Her power is definitely begun from the inside and sort of emanates outward. I mean, it radiates outward. She's a force of personality. My Marie in my vision of her. She is kind of an outsider in all things. I mean, born a bastardess, right? An illegitimate child of Geoffrey, who of Anjou and Maine, and not really recognized and not really part of the family. And her family dies or goes to nunneries early. And so she's basically left on her own. And then from there, she is just kind of rude. She's uncouth. I mean, she's very well educated because she had to take over the operations of her family estate, but then she's kicked out of there too. And then she goes to Eleanor of Aquitaine's court, is kicked out of there for being too rude and unmarriageable, and has to go and spend the rest of her life in a nunnery, which is like a horrible thing for this young girl who only loves romances of courtly love, who loves the court, who loves finery, who would like to be in the court for the rest of her life.
In a way, this is a cradle to grave book about this, the decades where she comes to herself to find out where life takes her, and then she transforms this abbey into a haven for a growing community of religious women.
Yeah, she does. She does. And she wasn't given great materials to work with, but she does the best she absolutely can because she loves the women around her. I think that her motivation comes from there and from her desire to show Eleanor, who kicked her out, that she was a worthy person, worthy of respect and maybe even awe.
Warren Groff is our guest on this week's book show. The novel is Matrix, is just out from Riverhead Books. I was fascinated by the title. I had to look it up a couple of times, actually, in different sources, because I couldn't figure out exactly. The word is used, I think, once within the text, and it is not the definition that I was aware of for what Matrix meant. So I assume you are looking at an ancient definition of a Latin definition of Matrix?
Yeah. Matrix comes from the Latin for mother. I think it was used maybe twice in the book. There's a seal matrix, which yes. is the thing that you press into wax in order to seal up letters. But matrix is also used in terms of mother and in terms of Eve as Eve as the great mother of us all. So the word is astonishing. It's a beautiful word, an absolutely like wonderful word that as soon as you know it, you see it everywhere, not just on Keanu Reeves films. You see it in geology, right? It's the substrate in which gems are set. You see it in organizational structures. You see it in sculpture, right? It's the form on which sculptures are built and replicated. It's just this wonderful, flexible, weird word that reverberates in different ways through the text.
There's so many things that are beautiful about this book. And actually, before I get into those, let me just ask you about the writing, because this seems to be, and I don't know how you're going to take this, but this book seems to be something that poured out of you, that it is almost breathless in its telling, because it is so beautifully told, and the language is just sumptuous. I mean, it's just beautiful, and which I know, of course, is hard work. So to say that it just flows out of you seems to undermine the point of how hard you worked on it. But there is a breathless quality to it.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. It did take a lot of work to make it
sure.
breathless and light and short. I mean, I think one of the initial drafts, I write in many, many drafts. One of the initial drafts is over 600 pages. And I really had to condense everything and rewrite in order to make it fit into as narrow a frame as I could.
Why did you want the frame to be narrow? It didn't have to be.
No, but it felt necessary for this book. And again, that's one of those things that I think it's a gut level thing. I think that this book required a sharpness of a blade. And if there was too much looseness in it or too much excess, the impact would have been much, much less. So I actually whittled a huge amount out of it and turn it into something swift. It needed to be swift.
The advance of time, as we go from one year or one decade to the next, we often get to the next place by a description of Marie and her aging body as a way of explaining of how old she is now and where she is in her life.
I thought very deeply about this because the way that I was sort of thinking about the middle age people or the middle ages and the middle age people in the book was with a great deal of attention to the animal body. Back in that time, there weren't a lot of markers of time passing in terms of clocks, right? People didn't really understand what exact time it was at any given moment. I mean, you kind of looked at the sky and saw if the sun was immediately overhead and you thought it was about lunchtime. I took that idea and went pretty deep into the body in order to sort of explain a lot of what was going on in the text itself, because the body is the first place of knowledge, right? The body is where we receive information and then translate it into abstraction. And Marie is very much a physical person, which doesn't mean that she's not intelligent. She's obviously the most intelligent person in this book, other than maybe Eleanor of Aquitaine. But the way that she knows the world is through her body. She's an animal, and as we are all animals, but I think often we forget that fact. And it's necessary for this book for her to respond through the body to the other people around her, to the world, to even God. Like her experiences of God are ecstatic experiences through the body.
you write about the nuns who are having sex with other nuns, about Marie being with other nuns, nuns who become pregnant by sleeping with people who are working on the abbey as it grows. And by that, we see a life. And I read in an interview that you gave, and I highlighted this line because I thought it was amazing. And you talking about writing about sex, where you say, I write in opposition in a certain way. I get a lot of joy of pushing against what is written. Talk a little bit about that, because that fascinates me, that is something that maybe not on just the issue of sex solely, but that it is something that you wanted to accomplish in telling this story, that you have you have a little bit of a gripe there that you want to air.
No, I don't think it was a gripe per se. You know, I write in opposition in order to understand what I understand. I think that, you know, you don't know the boundaries of your knowledge until you come across it and push really hard, right? And so I think often I write in opposition to given knowledge, to like the given story or like the single story. And in opposition, I try to complicate it or I try to undermine it. That's what I mean by opposition, not the simple idea of writing against the past, right, which it would be foolish to do, or writing against, say, men. Men don't even really figure in this book. I'm not writing against them.
Right.
I'm writing against perception. I'm writing against, you know, perhaps like a larger idea, this idea that men traditionally have been the ones to tell the stories. So what happens if there's a book written only in the perception of women, through the perception of women, for women? And it's obviously, like, I would hope that this book is read by men too, right? Like, I love men. But I guess the oppositional aspect of that is, well, why would a man not want to read about women, right? What is it?
Right.
Why would this not be something that you wouldn't want to pick up? And obviously, Joe, you are a great reader. You're not the one that I'm talking about.
No, I understand.
But I think that I'm also almost constantly taking received knowledge and trying to poke at it, trying to push at it, trying to see if I can wobble it a little bit.
So on that point, you say, I made a vow that I would never write another novel without a sex scene in it, because the reception of some of my sex scenes in the past has been so brutal and so deeply anti-feminist. And that seems like, yeah, okay, I'll show you.
That is definitely oppositional.
And you do it beautifully. That's the thing, is that you do it beautifully. The descriptions are absolutely gorgeous, because it's a real relationship. It's a need for really of both women that you're describing at any given time.
All the women. Yeah.
Yes.
And to have that experience written, you know, one of the things that I was sort of dazzled by in my research was that this idea that women's desire for other women wasn't a sin because the people writing about it didn't realize that it actually even existed, right? Because the people writing about it were men. And often chaste men, often priests or monks who had relatively little exposure to the bodies of women, so therefore believed that the locus of sin was in the man, or women were sinners, but it was, you know, it required a man in order to complete the act of sin. So to actually have this desire, which obviously existed in people, because people, you know, have sexual impulses and have since the beginning of time, to have this sort of come back into the story, even my imagined story of Marie Defonce, was really important to me.
Warren Groff is our guest. The new novel is Matrix. You write about maybe a third into the book. You write, And with the rose, the Virgin made a labyrinth in the forest encircling the abbey to show Marie that she must do the like. She must build a labyrinth. The abbey had always been an easy quarter day's walk from town, but if a labyrinth with a secret passage were built around it, a road that was so complex it would dismay all but the most determined visitors, she could hold her daughters aloof from the corrupting world. There would be no authority but Marie's authority in this place, and they could stay on this piece of earth where the place has always stood, but her daughters would be removed, enclosed, safe. They would be self-sufficient, entire unto themselves, an island of women. That is a beautiful paragraph.
Aw, thanks.
But it sets up really the second half of the book as this labyrinth, which is a fascinating concept in and of itself, that is being, because we see the pros, we read about the pros and cons of that, of how, yes, this can keep people safe and protected, but that's not really how you're looking at it, is it?
Not necessarily, no. It's there's always a push-pull here and sort of a complicated and kind of gorgeous duality between freedom and security. And I think in this particular case, what the nuns gain in terms of security of being an island of themselves, distant from corrupting impulses in the world, also means that freedom gets a little bit curtailed too. So it's a, I guess it's somewhat of a meditation on that idea.
As I mentioned before, you get to look at other subjects. You write in the book, what she does not see behind her is the disturbance her nuns have left in the forest. It will take a half century to lure these tiny birds back. So you are addressing how we as human beings can screw things up.
I think I'm also addressing that wherever there are humans, there's human-made climate change. Our first ancestor who learned how to strike a fire created climate change, right? Like burning logs that otherwise would have melted into the forest floor, feeding moths and lichen and beetles, is now gone up in smoke and contributed carbon into the atmosphere, right? So there's no such thing as humans without climate change. But the attitudes with which it has been embarked upon, I do see very clear emanations out of the Middle Age, right? There's this idea in Genesis, a dominion, you know, God gave Adam and Eve dominion over the earth, which I think should be nurturing. It should be shepherding, steering. But I see increasingly through the last millennium that it has been misread as domineering, domination. And I do, you know, I think a lot of that comes out of the early church and attitudes of the early church.
How much did you want to stay away from, and how much did you want to adhere to religion?
Religion was the landscape of this book, just mm-hmm. like the southeast of England was the landscape of this book. It was the world in which the book had to be written, of course, in order to make sense in time and space. And it's not that I didn't want to write about ideas of faith or loss of faith or gaining faith, because these are all actually in the book. But I think that my concern, at least in terms of Marie and the way that she grew into her role and into her own strange and slightly twisted set of beliefs, has less to do with religion and more to do with God. And I think that they're not necessarily the same thing. I think one's experience of God is a much more personal thing. And her understanding of God is directly related to her love of the women around her and her desire to create a church of herself around them.
And she's interpreting this as it goes on, and her fellow nuns are coming and saying to her, well, this is what we should believe, right? And she will interpret that of how it is and basically give them another interpretation, another idea of how they can look at and understand what it is that she wants them to do.
Oh, absolutely. And I think some of her actions in this book would have been seen as absolutely blasphemous. In fact, right. I know for a fact she was blasphemous and committed some heresies too. That said, I found precedent in a lot of my historical research of people sort of making forays into each direction of her blasphemy. So it's not that any of these single things was actually unheard of in the historical record. They occurred. I don't want to say them because I don't want to do spoilers.
Right. No, I understand.
Kind of, I don't know. If I hope that that's okay. But I tried very, very, very hard not to put anything into this book that didn't have some sort of precedent, even if it was, like a story being told that hadn't actually existed at the time, even if it was just like obviously a myth. It still went into the book. I had to make sure that everything in the book was sort of predicated on something that I had read in the historical record.
There are nuns in this book who take great exception to some of the things that she's doing, but they ultimately go along with it because they're going along with the order, with the vow that they made, which is fascinating because you do it in so few words, but you can feel that internal struggle so clearly.
Yeah, I think they also did it out of the very human desire to not make waves. I think often in all of our lives, we tend sometimes to go along to not cause a problem. It's just easier. I see that as something that I myself do, and I'm not proud of it. So I think that's probably just a human impulse.
Lauren Groff's new novel is Matrix. It is published by Riverhead Books. Lauren, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.